Hey now, we are getting over, and I am the Silver King, Adam Silverstein, here to lead you through these hard times. With episode 583 of your favorite professional wrestling podcast. That's right, Getting Over is back once again, and as usual, we have a loaded show for you. Once again, it is Thursday, so you know exactly what that means. We are here to break down everything that happened over the last week in AEW and NXT, but not only that, this will also serve as your AEW Dynasty Ultimate Preview, along with your NXT Spring Break and Preview, a two-week special television show going off starting next Tuesday. So, as noted, we have a ton to discuss on this edition of the Getting Over Wrestling Podcast. So, folks, let's not waste any time. Allow the Silver King to remind you that this show
is all about Defy.
So head on over to Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Leave a five-star rating on Apple. Take a little extra time. Leave a five-star written review. If you do, we will read it live right here on the show. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Getting Overcast for episode drops, news, analysis, highlights, all of that good stuff. It is also where you can send in tweets and DMs, questions, comments, thoughts, whatever they might be for the show. We will do our best to read them on air, but no matter what, we will do our best to respond to you. Please also remember,
I happen to love the number 5.
And I hope you do as well, because for $5 a month or $50 for the entire year, you can become an official Getting Overhead. Just visit buymeacoffee.com/gettingover. Sign up. You will get bonus audio, the fastest 5 minutes in professional wrestling, instant reactions to Raw, NXT, Dynamite, and SmackDown every week, along with exclusive news posts every Friday. Again, it's real simple. Buymeacoffee.com/gettingover. We would greatly appreciate your support. Now, as mentioned, we have a ton to discuss on this edition of the Getting Over Wrestling Podcast. We're kind of back in a groove. It's tough to say that when we have a pay-per-view coming up with AEW Dynasty, a two-week TV special with NXT Spring Break-In, and we're really not that far removed from WWE Backlash happening over in France. So while I say we're back to normal, maybe the Silver King just feels like he's back to normal because I'm back at home in my chair in front of my microphone, which is, of course, where I love to be. But we're going to bring as much content to you as possible over the next few weeks. And of course, it continues with this show. Now, because this is an ultimate preview episode, we will tackle AEW on the second half of the show. This is the way it's going to go. We're going to talk NXT. We're going to give you a mini preview for NXT Spring Break in week one. Obviously, next week, we'll give you a preview for week two. Then we'll talk about everything that happened across the week in AEW. And then we'll hit you with that AEW Dynasty Ultimate Preview. So if you happen to be listening to the show later in the week, or maybe even on Sunday, right before Dynasty, be sure to check the timestamps in your episode description. You can find exactly where to jump to, so you just get a preview of that show. But as always, I hope you listen to the entire episode. As mentioned, let's go ahead and kick it off with NXT. So Ilya Dragunov was informed by Ava that she didn't really find it fair that Trick Williams was going to have to work this week while Ilya was off. So she decided he would have a match, and always a fighter, he obviously had no problem with that. He suggested an open challenge. So a ton of wrestlers ultimately ran out to the ring for the open challenge. They prevented one another from getting in. All of a sudden, from the opposite side of the ring, Javon Evans runs in. He jumps, I think, off the barricade, onto the announce table, then onto the ring apron, and then he springboards over Dragunov into the ring and goes face-to-face with him, which was just so damn cool. And I love the way NXT treats open challenges. We criticize it with AEW all the time. They do a terrible job. WWE, much better, but still problematic occasionally. NXT, the vast majority of the time, handles open challenges right. It should be a sprint. Everyone should be trying to get there to fight the NXT champion. And they should be preventing each other from getting in the ring. And then one person outsmarts them all and gets it. I'm not saying you have to do that exactly every single time. I just like the way they do it. That's all I'm trying to say. So, look, Evans got his ass beat, right, for a while. He popped up for a crescent kick to the throat. Fans were all about chanting Young OG for him. Ilya caught a seated springboard into a toss powerbomb, but Evans countered Constantine Special into a spectacular Spanish fly. Dragunov then chopped his ass, springing out of midair. He had a huge running knee. He got a two count. Evans countered Ilya midair into almost like a crucifix DDT. Unfortunately, the finish was a little bit odd. Evans jumped off the ropes into nothing. Ilya curled him onto his shoulders for a driver in the corner, then hit Torpedo Moscow for the win. High B+ grade for this match. It was just intense. And it's kind of insane that Evans' second ever NXT television match was against Dragunov. Like, talk about getting a rocket strapped to you. All of a sudden, you go from just debuting to fighting one of the 10 best wrestlers in the entire world. That is crazy. I have said it since WWE signed him, but I said it again every time I've seen him wrestle or seen a clip of him wrestle. I want every share of stock that exists in Javon Evans. He's 19 years old, probably 150 pounds soaking wet, and yet he seemingly has unlimited potential. Consider how much trust WWE needed to have in him to allow Evans to fight their champion 1 week before a crucial main event championship match. Clearly, major belief from Shawn Michaels, and that is excellent to see. Let's go and move to the main event of the show, which was Trick Williams against Carmelo Hayes inside a steel cage. They got an extended video package preceding it, pretty much just to give the crew time to set up the cage. Melo cut a short, intense promo backstage saying he was going to give Trick everything and take it all from him and ensure that basically his dreams are ruined. He called Trick ungrateful. Melo's security handed him a billy club through the cage just a minute into the match. Hayes completely dominated for a while. Trick caught Melo on the ropes for an avalanche bookend. Then he caught Hayes flying off the ropes for a regular bookend. And yes, we call them bookends when it comes to NXT because Booker T's on commentary, and I feel like it's only right to do that. Melo hit the first 48, but Trick stopped the flying bulldog with a superhero landing. All the security tried to distract and interfere. Melo missed a chair shot with Trick coming off the ropes, hitting Trick shot into the chair to get the win in about 13 minutes. Trick then climbed the cage, trash-talked Dragunov, who was standing in the crow's nest, holding the title. This was simultaneously better and kind of worse than the stand-and-deliver match. Some of the sequences were smoother. The match was more exciting in a lot of parts. The ending, though, was similarly sudden and disappointing, given it was just one move without any false finishes. I don't know who's putting these matches together. I think they keep forgetting these are grudge matches between these guys. These should be epics. At least the one at Stand and Deliver should have been an epic. And I just don't understand why they're under-delivering. And I'll get to one person's thoughts on that in a moment. These guys had two opportunities to go to war together. And instead, they kind of had a pair of skirmishes that both of them left something to be desired. The matches I'm talking about, not the wrestlers. I said this on that instant analysis for Stand and Deliver. Like, maybe they didn't go all the way here purposefully because we know this is probably going to be revisited multiple times in the future. But more than anything, I have to assume it's most likely Williams being green and not keeping up with Hayes. His match with Dragunov was great. And maybe that's because that's a slower and more deliberate style while Carmelo operates faster. It's really tough to say. I went 3.5 stars B for this match. You could maybe go a quarter star higher, but I really wasn't into the finish. Trick was obviously the right expected and obvious winner, given he has a title match next. That made doing this in the first place confounding because he already got his one-on-one win clean, and we knew he wasn't going to lose. So now he's beaten Melo twice, and you're sending Melo up to the main roster off two losses. Just didn't really seem necessary. Now, look, I saw some straight-up ridiculous comment making the rounds on social media Thursday morning as I was prepping the show, and it basically said that Trick is, quote, not that good a wrestler. Now, I'm not sure what other shows you guys listen to or who you follow on Twitter or what you read on Reddit or whatever the case. But one of the reasons we cover NXT the way we do is because it requires the context of being a developmental show. No matter what WWE terms NXT and whether they do it to sell media rights or to get people to watch, it doesn't really matter. If it's a developmental brand, a third brand, it doesn't change the level of inexperience held by the vast majority of the roster, including Williams. Trick has been wrestling for 2.5 years. He has more charisma in his right arm than wrestlers with decades of experience have in their entire bodies. He's athletic. He's eye-catching. He just makes you want to pay attention to him. To suggest he's not that good when he barely has any experience, yet is more over than a ton of other so-called big stars in the industry, is patently absurd. Let's play up a comparison here. And let me be very clear when I make this comparison. I mean zero disrespect to this person. But you have Daniel Garcia, who is one of the most talented young wrestlers in the game right now, The guy can do everything you want in the ring, and he's improving his charisma and promos outside of the ring. Do you know how long Daniel Garcia has been wrestling? 7 years. He's had 334 matches, 207 of them you can watch, whether on AEW or broadcast elsewhere. Trick has wrestled 92 times. He has less than one third of his matches, 47 of them on broadcast, less than one quarter, or I'm sorry, about one quarter on broadcast. He's a neophyte. Putting this in sports terms, comparing these two guys, just as an example, would be like comparing a redshirt sophomore in college to a third-year pro. And yet, between them, who has more charisma and character and draws better? Again, I really like Daniel Garcia. This is no slight on him whatsoever. I could have picked anyone else for this example. But the answer to that question is Trick Williams. So I have no idea what's not that good about Trick. What's not that good is that shit take. Allow me to move on. Tony D'Angelo hit the ring with the family, saying their push for the NXT title didn't go as planned, but the family is stronger than ever with plenty of gold still to pursue. He was cut off mid-sentence by No Quarter Catch Crew, which is now led by Charlie Dempsey. D'Angelo intimated that they came to take care of someone that No Quarter couldn't on their own. In other words, Drew Gulak. And he asked when they were going to pay up for that hit. Dempsey said they didn't think there was a charge, and D'Angelo was just doing it for the good of the industry. They took a dump on Gulak right here. Straight up killed this guy off. I did not expect that, even despite the Ronda Rousey shit. Dempsey demanded D'Angelo take his eyes off his Heritage Cup. He called him a scumbag. That led to a six-man brawl. It was a clunky-ass segment. That's really all I can say about it. I did not expect them to just straight up kill off Gulak. And I guess, like, they could do an investigation and bring him back, and you can kayfabe it, which has happened numerous other times when people have been either killed off or taken off of TV for injury or whatever the case might be. It kind of seems like they're just done with the guy when they kill him off, kind of like they did, Two Dimes, back when they fired him, and he eventually wound up in AEW and then just stopped appearing on television. So I found this to be a pretty interesting situation. Dijak fought Noam Dar. Dijak literally rotated Dar into a full toss over the ropes outside. He also hit a toss suplex and high justice. Dar came back with a fisherman's buster, running dropkick into the steel steps, and a back elbow for a false finish. He also countered a discus lariat with a Superman punch, only for Dijak to drill him with a discus boot. Oro Mensah distracted, wearing a Retribution-style mask. Just as Dijak was about to hit Feast Your Eyes, that distraction led to a super kick, and it opened Dijak up for a Nova Roller. And what, at least to me, was a surprise win for Noam Dar. High B+, maybe low A- match here. These guys were awesome together. Now, I figured Dijak was going to stay hot because he did not take the fall in the North American title match, but here he is back to losing. I'm just confused about what his role is in NXT at this juncture. He's only 36. He should be someone winning titles and helping run the brand at a minimum, not just being a gateway opponent for everyone else. I don't understand the reluctance to give this guy a run of wins and a title when he's arguably the second best and most consistent guy on the entire roster besides Dragunov. This was a fun-ass opener. The arrow for Dijak continues to point up, but I want to see it pointing up to gold, not pointing up to getting into big feuds and losing the final match every single time. Josh Briggs was getting advice from a trainer about his two broken ribs. Ivar came up, making sure he was okay. Briggs said he was ready to go after Obafemi. Ivar cautioned he should fully heal up, let him fight Oba first. He'd give him a shot at the title either way. Obviously, Briggs had no interest in that, so they set up a one-on-one match. And I know broken ribs are like a pain tolerance deal. Did seem kind of dumb that this guy was just going to fight anyway. Plus, why would Briggs get a rematch and not Dijak? So that didn't really make sense. So we got Ivar against Briggs. Ivar got rolling first. Briggs was taped up and continuously sold the ribs on offense and defense. Ivar then hit a rotating slam and double underhook Liger Bomb. Briggs failed on a ringside powerbomb, got driven ribs first into the steel steps, ate a roundhouse kick, and then took Doomsault from Ivar for the finish. Good establishment win for Ivar in NXT ahead of a title match. Smart way to protect Briggs, selling the ribs. Femi watched from backstage. He called the win interesting, and he walked away. And then off screen, he slammed a door into Oro Mensah's head, which is always funny. They keep doing that gag. I would really like to see Briggs. I'm not saying he should be DDP, Diamond Dallas Page, and have the ribs wrapped for his entire career. It would be kind of funny if he did it for 2 months, though. So let's see if they go ahead and do that. Tatum Paxley was playing with broken dolls and WWE women's action figures, saying she always wanted to fit in as a little girl, but she realized nobody wanted to play with her, especially the cool girls. She said the NXT women's title is the one thing that was always good to her. She mentioned all the amazing women to hold it, Asuka, Charlotte Flair, etc., before breaking up over Lyra Valkyria, saying that she loved her and wanted to be her because she was the paradigm of good and Lyra actually let her in. But now that Lyra lost the title, which is what Tatum loves most, Lyra broke her heart and is nothing to her. I'm not exaggerating when I say I absolutely loved this. It was unique conceptually, just as a way to obsess over the title. Tatum delivered it expertly, and I am fully 100% bought into her character. This was probably one of the best character building vignettes I have seen in a long time, any company or brand. She's among the most interesting women in NXT right now. And let me just say this as well. For anyone comparing her to Alexa Bliss or Alba Fyre and Isla Dawn, if you cannot differentiate between someone mentally deranged, Alexa, a couple of witches practicing witchcraft, Alba and Isla, and an obsessive goth stalker, Tatum, that's a you problem. They're all completely different characters. Just because they might wear dark colors or be a little unhinged, that's a character trait. It's not a character. Be better. Andre Chase had a heart-to-heart with Thea Hale explaining that he was having gambling problems before she even had her match, and he believed in her so much, he put it all on the line betting on her to win the women's title. And then when he saw tears streaming down her cheeks during the match itself, he had no other choice but to throw in the towel. He cared about her far more than the money, the university, or anything else. Thea was angry that Chase didn't tell her initially, and she was pissed off, especially that she was led to think the entire time that he didn't believe in her, which is why he threw in the towel. Chase said he was just trying to protect her, so Thea got all amped up, apologized, hugged him, and thanked him for believing in her the entire time. This actually worked for me. It closed the loop on the story. It made sense of everything. The question now is where Chase, you, and all of them go from here, because there's no more real story with the university. So I'm going to be curious to see what happens next. We had Paxley against Hale. Tatum was vicious here. She had an awesome submission, kind of like a modified tarantula, where Paxley held Hale in the air with her own back to the canvas, ankles hooked, wrenching at her face. Some might say,
"It looked good, but she's got me saying, hey now."
Jasmine Nix distracted as Thea hit the world's smallest slam and a rolling senton. I didn't even know it was called that. That's such a smart name. JC Jane then tripped her, springing off the ropes as Tatum caught her in a crucifix pinning combination for the win. Thea went after JC, with them getting separated after the bell. In the ring, Lyra was furiously kicking Tatum's ass, two pull-apart brawls happening simultaneously. This was a really fun match and an overall segment. There are so many women's storylines in NXT. It's cool to see a few of them converge. Thea's coming along quickly. It's pretty wild to see. I need more of an extended look at Tatum to better judge her in ring. She does seem to have improved markedly. I just don't know that she's top tier of the division yet. I don't think she's that close. Roxanne Perez was talking shit backstage after this was over. She was happy to see Lyra and Tatum fighting each other and suggested that she could give a title match to the winner. Then she started talking about Ava sarcastically, basically saying how easy it is to just make matches and that she can do it that easily by just conjuring it up in her head. Ava overheard her and agreed her job actually is easy because all she has to do is make it a triple threat match. And I remain so pleasantly surprised at the job Ava is doing as a general manager. You would think that she'd have needed some type of adjustment period to get into the role. She is swimming already. And it's always fun when a heel gets their comeuppance that quickly from an authority figure. Idris Sanofe and Malik Blade fought Authors of Pain. All of Final Testament entered for the match. I believe the Faces had a new entrance theme. Earlier in the show, we saw a social media video of them training with Brynlee Rhys. AOP caught Blade flying outside and then basically powerbombed him into Idris during a Tope Suicida attempt. AOP added Super Collider and got the win. Nathan Frazier and Axiom were stopped from confronting them after the bell. There's something that just works with AOP murdering developmental talent compared to trying to go toe-for-toe with like great tag teams on the main roster. This was so reminiscent of their first run in NXT. It was a fun short match, and I really kind of think they should just stay down there. I realize at some point they can't because they are just so much bigger and more dominant than the rest of the division, but they are just better in NXT than they are on the main roster. It's as simple as that. Sol Ruca fought Lola Vice. Contrast of styles here with Sol hitting a ton of athletic moves. Lola just using brute strength, including a hip attack in the corner. Ruca hit a standing moonsault and was ready to go to the finish when Blair Davenport pulled the top rope on her cartwheel DDT attempt. So Vice kicked her in the face and got the win. Lola appears less and less ready for the spotlight every match that passes. She doesn't really sell or bump well. Her offense is kind of clunky. Sol is really far ahead of her despite being injured for months. I thought they picked the wrong winner, but it made sense because of what was coming next, because Sol later demanded from Ava a no DQ against Blair next week, saying she will not stop until she gets carried out of the arena. And then Natalya on the Titantron challenged Lola to an NXT Underground match in 2 weeks. Hell yeah. Carmen Petrovic said backstage she'll be training with Natty for the match. Lola walked up talking shit, saying Natty has guts but can't handle her heat. Vice promised that she would have someone notable in her corner as well. It'd be really interesting if it's like a UFC person. I have a feeling it's probably going to be like Shayna Baszler, but that would still be pretty cool. Natty in an Underground match is sick, and this should help Lola because it feeds into her MMA background where she is more comfortable. First women's Underground match ever. I'm glad they're doing it. The first two that they've done with the men have been awesome. NXT Anonymous found Ridge Holland speaking with Ava, basically saying he didn't think he would be wrestling so soon after retiring. No shit. Joaquin Wilde came up telling Ridge to give it up and just face his real personality, so Holland choked him up against the wall and stormed off. Wilde dodged Holland in the match as he punched a ring post. Ridge pounced him inside, then pulled him up from a cover as Sean Spears slowly walked out just to watch him. And he was back wearing that really strange vest and dress pants combo with no shirt. It's a bad look, dude. Holland caught him on a tope suicida with a power slam ringside and then hit a cradle DDT for the win. He looked at his hands after the bell and left immediately, storming past Spears and bumping his shoulder as Sean laughed. I just gotta say, like, at this point, none of this really works for me. Holland so quickly and easily coming out of retirement was dumb. I was high on him for a long time. You guys will remember me singing his praises, but he just does not have it. He needs a tag team partner to play off both in and out of the ring. Someone with more personality, someone who can move faster, be more exciting bell to bell. He had that in Pete Dunne and they decided to break them up. I hope I'm proven wrong because he seems like a good dude. I just don't think I'm wrong. And lastly, Ariana Grace met Gigi Dolin in a park so they could go dress shopping. Gigi wanted to wear black. Ariana kept reminding her that she has to believe she's a princess if she's going to become one. Grace spotted an emerald dress from across a store. Dolin said she'd make it her own. And then she made a ton of noise in the dressing room. She came out with it all cut up and styled. There was black lace there. This was very like teen movie, Disney Channel sitcom. I don't say that in a bad way. That's just what it was. And if you enjoy that type of stuff, then you definitely enjoyed this. So that wraps up NXT this week. Let's go ahead and move to our NXT Spring Break-In Week 1 preview. We're not going deep in depth. This is not an ultimate preview, just a regular preview. We're going to talk about, though, the matches that are all set for TV next week. We have No Quarter Catch Crew against D'Angelo Family in a six-man. I gotta believe D'Angelo's win this. They're coming off Tony D'Angelo losing at NXT Stand and Deliver. No Quarter Catch Crew has two different guys in Damon Kemp and Miles Bourne who can get pinned. I mean, D'Angelo Family has people who can get pinned too. It makes a lot more sense for the heels to get a win and then for one of them to go after the Heritage Cup at a later date. Otherwise, if the faces win, I guess they're faces. I don't even know that they're actually baby faces. But if the current Heritage Cup holders win, let's put it that way, there's no reason to continue the storyline. So I have D'Angelo's winning this. Sol Ruca against Blair Davenport. This one is super interesting, because Blair has not really been used in NXT like she should be, and she's well beyond NXT in terms of her skill and ability. Sol, on the other hand, is just coming back, shouldn't necessarily be losing a match like this, but at the same time, you would say, well, Davenport shouldn't be losing to Ruca, especially if she's staying in NXT. I think this might be one of those situations where Davenport's getting called up before any of us expect her to, before she's won the NXT title, before she's done anything in a supreme way, something along the lines of like when Apollo Crews got called up to the main roster. They need more women. They need women who can lose matches. And I'm not trying to say that Davenport doesn't have potential on the main roster. It just doesn't seem like WWE believes in her that much. And what do we talk about all the time? Like, put on good matches on the main roster with people who can lose. That way other people look good. We talk about it with AEW as well. They just keep using like these random jobber of the month people who eventually they sign to contracts and whatever the case might be. And they lose like eight consecutive matches when what they really should be doing is having them fight people on the actual roster. I think Davenport might be part of the WWE draft. So because of that, I have Ruka getting what I could only call an upset victory here and hopefully catapulting her a little bit in this NXT women's division. I could see her as one of the top potential winners of that new NXT Women's North American Championship. Another thing, I was kind of surprised there was no further announcement about that this week on NXT. I thought they'd have a tournament announcement or something. They just said it exists again. So that was interesting. Let's move to the Women's Championship. Roxanne Perez defending against Lyra Valkyria and Tatum Paxley. Roxy just won the title. I mean, even if she's getting called up, which I don't think she's going to be, nor do I think she should be, just given her age, her still relative inexperience, and the fact that she can develop as a heel in NXT, just like Bron Breakker did a year ago. You got to keep the title on Roxy. One of them between Lyra and Tatum obviously will take the fall. My guess is Tatum screws over Lyra from possibly pinning Roxy. They get into it. Tatum beats her down. Roxy throws Tatum out of the ring, pins Lyra, gets the 1-2-3. Again, just my guess. And lastly, we move to the NXT Championship, Ilya Dragunov against Trick Williams. The stipulation here is that Trick would be forced to leave NXT if he does not win the title. As I said when this was announced, the stipulation really came out of nowhere because Dragunov has never disrespected Williams, nor did he have any real reason to want to jettison him from the brand other than the fact that he asked for another title match, which was his right because he kind of got screwed the last time they fought. So the stipulation doesn't make any sense. And the only reason it exists is to put Trick in a do or die situation. The other thing that doesn't make sense is it's not a two-way stipulation. It should be loser leaves NXT because Dragunov almost certainly is getting called up to the main roster. And therefore, I'm not totally sure who's going to win this match. I mean, I know the obvious prediction is Trick, but at the same time, I would love for Ilya to retain the title, get called up, start working on Raw or SmackDown, and then still be NXT champion, kind of like Kevin Owens. So because of the stipulation, and Trick is nowhere near for the main roster, then I have Trick winning and becoming the new NXT champion. But as much as I like him, as much as I defended him earlier, I completely disagree with that booking. I do not think he should be holding the title. I understand what it did for Bron Breakker, and they want to see if Trick can do the same thing. Totally get it. You could also put the title on Dijak, wait 6 months, and then put it on Trick and get him another period of time, 6 months, in the example I just gave you, of more seasoning before he's champion. Braun was further along, especially for his second title reign, than Trick is now. But it does seem to be the decision that they are making. So that wraps up NXT Spring Break. And as a quick preview, let's go ahead and move over to AEW. As mentioned, we're going to talk about the week in AEW, and then we're going to give you the AEW Dynasty Ultimate Preview. And while Vintage Chris Vanini will not be joining for that like he so frequently does, we do believe he will be available for the AEW Dynasty Instant Analysis Podcast coming this Sunday right here on the Getting Over Wrestling Podcast. Now, before we get into AEW, the shows this week, Tony Khan had a media call ahead of Dynasty, and I just wanted to single out something he said when he was asked about fan feedback on airing the Brawl in footage. His response was that TBS called him and said good job on the rating, and that ratings are the number one source of fan feedback for the company. And obviously, I laughed at that. I'm not going to get into the whole thing, I promise. But if that's the case, ratings have been going down for the last 2 months, even in the face of Tony Khan signing three massive free agents. The only reason they went up was because he teased CM Punk footage and people tuned in because they thought they were going to get something explosive. Instead, they got something that just confirmed everything they already believed. So I wouldn't necessarily call that a source of pride for them right now, especially when AEW doesn't have great ratings. Tony just decides not to tweet about them, or he'll point to a cage match rating or something else, some other metric that he's conjured up as what really matters. So I found that to be a little bit ridiculous. Again, end of rant, not going to go into it. A couple other AEW related news items. Your standard like tribal accounts on social media, they're boosting a story from Forbes that shows WWE being the second most valuable property in combat sports at $6.8 billion. This despite $1.3 billion in revenue and a valuation from the TKO purchase that, let's not forget, was way more than 6.8. I want to say it was between 8 and 9 billion. This has AEW, the same article, being the third most valuable property at $2 billion. This despite only $250 million in revenue. So to show you how asinine this is, Forbes is suggesting that WWE, a company established over decades, the industry leader by a mile, setting gate records and ratings records, not in terms of overall all time, but like recent time, they're suggesting that company, WWE, is worth 5 times annual revenue. While the contender brand in AEW, after existing for only 5 years without a new TV deal yet, although they will get one, et cetera, ratings are going down, attendance is going down, they're suggesting AEW is worth 8 times their revenue. That is completely ridiculous. It would be generous but fair to say AEW is 5 times revenue, $1.25 billion. But they have so many liabilities compared to their assets. They're not cash flow positive from a profit standpoint. They are losing money on talent. They got killed by the Fight Forever video game. They're about to be profitable for the first time with this new TV deal. I've explained that many times here. But suggesting they are worth more than a 5 times revenue figure while the industry leader, which is raking in record profits, is only at that 5 time multiplier, it is straight up asinine. I'll remind you, Tony may have Forbes in his pocket a little bit. You'll remember they did that feature story a couple years ago with the strange art. They've done a couple puff pieces on AEW in the past. But this, without any reasoning or any details provided, to value AEW at $2 billion is straight up ridiculous. Now, that said, something is worth what someone else will pay for it. And perhaps there's a wrestling fan billionaire out there who would come in and say, you know what? AEW is worth $2 billion. I'd love to buy it from Tony Khan for $2 billion. Now, he wouldn't sell it anyway, so it doesn't really matter. But that is plausible. But to suggest they're worth 8 times revenue when they're not making profit at this juncture, at the time that we're having this conversation, is absolutely insane. Speaking of insane, by the way, one more thing before we break down AEW. Some of you probably saw that statement from the Oklahoma Sports Commission condemning AEW for allowing Nyla Rose to perform in their state just because she's transgendered. That shit is asinine. Like, that's the definition of asinine. Tony had a really nice response. He got her back when he was asked about it on Thursday. So kudos to him. And honestly, if I was him, I would either refuse to run the state or I would put her front and effing center on the card next time I'm running Oklahoma, dare them to sue me, and then counter sue when they do. That shit's ridiculous. She deserves better. And good for Tony standing up for her. So I just want to put that out there. Let's go ahead and break down everything that happened this week in AEW. I'm going to save a little bit of it for the AEW Dynasty Ultimate Preview. Of course, we will get to that at the latter stages of the show. Before we get to the matches, obviously I did the math on which matches this week were built via storyline and which ones were not. And this one was tough to calculate, actually, because so many of them had super limited or tangential build, but not direct build for there actually to be that specific match that was happening. I gave a bunch of partial credit. The way my math had it work out was 44% of matches this week had some semblance to significant storyline build. Is that better than recent? Yeah, mostly. But at the same time, we're still nowhere near that threshold that I was hoping for of 70%. We'll see if they get there coming out of Dynasty. So with that said, let's go match by match and segment by segment. And then, of course, AEW Dynasty Ultimate Preview at the end. We'll start with Collision, where Bryan Danielson and Claudio Castagnoli fought Kyle Fletcher and Powerhouse Hobbs. This was announced on Rampage the night before, with Don Callis wanting his guys to tear apart the faces of the BCC, win or lose. This technically fit within the larger feud, but since Bryan and Will Ospreay have only been operating out of respect for one another, and I said as much last week, Ospreay's been nowhere near Callis. It really kind of was out of left field for them just to do this match, accept it, be willing to feud with them. So I gave this half credit. BCC cut an impassioned promo backstage on Saturday that was one of Claudio's better efforts in AEW. Hobbs started using a chair with the referee pulling it away. The heels cleaned off the announce table. Claudio ran off of it, hit a hurricanrana on Fletcher ringside, and then caught him with a neuralizer inside for the win. The table never really came into play other than that. Konosuke Takeshita attacked after the bell, hit Danielson with a brainbuster on the ramp. It was a really hot post-match attack. As I stated previously, there's really been nothing about this feud where Danielson getting attacked makes sense. My hope was that Ospreay on Dynamite would criticize Callis and the family for getting involved without asking him, given, again, their entire feud has been built on respect, and Ospreay has not been involved with Callis whatsoever since returning, other than fighting the other members of the family, which he never really asked to do, just matches that Callis booked. I mean, 3.75 stars, B+ for the match. One other note on Fletcher. He won the ROH TV title on December 23rd. Since then, he is 0-4 on AEW TV with singles losses to Ospreay and Chris Jericho, plus two tag team losses where he took the fall both times. No one is getting title matches from it. This is just absolutely horrendous booking. Either the ROH titles matter or they don't matter. Someone's got to make a decision. On Dynamite, Jon Moxley opened the show as the new IWGP World Heavyweight Champion. Fun tidbit. Only 5 total days elapsed with a member of the Shield not being a world champion. Roman Reigns and Seth Rollins lost their titles on April 7th, and Mox won his beating Tetsuya Naito on April 12th. We have not watched that match yet. We'll try to get it into next week's show. Huge reaction for him on Dynamite. The promo started generic before he talked about winning this title, ending a 5-year quest of him spilling sweat and blood. Then he got into like the pro AEW stuff, and it was like the 3rd time this week and 6th time in the last 2 weeks that they've done something like this in the middle of a promo. Then he called out the Callis family. He dared them to go be violent with him given the attack from Saturday, but knowing they won't find him, he challenged Hobbs to a main event match next week. The goal being he would prove Hobbs is out of his depth and that Callis is feeding him lies. Despite some strangeness to this in parts, Mox can really do no wrong on the mic. His passion overcomes any oddities. In kayfabe, it probably would have made more sense for him to challenge Takeshka because he's the one who actually attacked Danielson and laid him out, not Hobbs. But Takeshka's the one guy in this group who wins his matches. So Hobbs can just go ahead and take another L to Mox next week. On Dynamite, Ospreay fought Claudio. Ospreay caught him springing off the ropes with a super kick and hit a perfect tiger driver. Claudio actually got most of his offense in the early going. Ospreay hit a cool kip up in Zaguri, then countered a Ricola bomb with Claudio landing straight on his head. But luckily, it was a very soft landing and he was okay. Claudio caught an Oz Cutter midair for an inverted Death Valley driver. Ospreay came back with a running Spanish fly. By the way, also a burning hammer, I think is what it was supposed to be. Claudio countered Hidden Blade with a pop-up European uppercut. Ospreay climbed up, countering a swing, literally climbed up his body, and he countered it into a Tornado DDT. He also hit Cancun Tornado plus Hidden Blade for the win. This was an excellent, excellent match. Commentary called it dynamic. That was a perfect word for it. Straight up energy, bell to bell. Exceptional in every way. Will climbing Claudio like a tree to counter the swing. It was the best part of the match. One of the best parts of Dynamite. Ospreay's incredible bell to bell. You guys know this. 4.25 stars A. The rest of the Callis family attacked Claudio after the bell as Ospreay simultaneously left the ring. Mox's music hit for the save. Ospreay, he seemed to have his arms open, surprised at one point, but he didn't actually do anything to stop it. Mox took them out 1-on-3 at first before Claudio came to. Ospreay then yelled at the family and he stormed off. So he's angry, but he didn't do anything about it. So this got me halfway to what I hoped would happen, like I just said, coming out of Collision. I'm glad they addressed the fact that Ospreay doesn't necessarily want them doing it, but you got to admit it was kind of weakly done. And then immediately after this, AEW announced that Brian and Claudio would fight Callis family in a bunkhouse match on Collision. And that is 24 hours before Dynasty. They have been building the Danielson-Ospreay match for months. An epic dream match. Two of the best of all time going head-to-head, finding out who is the better wrestler. That is the entire story of the match. If this match is such a big deal, why the fuck is Bryan Danielson fighting at all, let alone in a hardcore stipulation match, one day before this huge career-defining showdown with Ospreay? What sense does that make? I thought it was stupid when Jey Uso fought Solo Sikoa on SmackDown 24 hours before he fought Jimmy at WrestleMania. This is that times 100 because it's basically the main event of Dynasty, and it's been promoted as an epic that both guys care about more than a title or anything else. There was no direct challenge. There was no reason for the stipulation, and there's no reason for Danielson to agree to this match in kayfabe. Mox or Wheeler Yuta should have been in this match in his place. This is just stupid ass booking as far as I'm concerned. On Rampage, the TBS title was on the line for some reason. Julia Hart defending against Layla Hirsch in an open house match. It went 3 minutes. It ended with probably the slowest inside cradle I've ever seen. It was off of a fake injury, but a title match, 3 minutes. One we told you was random and undeserved last week. They just did not need to do this whatsoever.
That is one big pile of shit.
On Dynamite, Mercedes Moné addressed being attacked last week, saying she would get payback on that bitch who hurt her. She assumed it was Julia Hart because the lights went off and she said she would be all healthy by Double or Nothing when she finally gets in the ring. Mercedes threatened both Julia and Willow Nightingale, basically saying she would take the title when she's healthy. This was actually her single best segment from start to finish since she debuted in AEW. None of the strange intonation, a direct, angry statement that was completely in storyline. I found this to be a hugely positive development. Also on Dynamite, Adam Copeland and Willow fought Brody King and Julia. Justin Roberts fixed his stupid rated R superstar ring announce. Thank heavens. Nightingale was shown attacked backstage, putting her Dynasty title match in doubt. The lights went out and back on with Brody attacking Cope. Put him in a chair, killed him with a running crossbody into the barricade. Cope rallied with an impaler DDT, but King countered a spear with a lariat. Willow came down and tagged in with Cope's boot. She hit a crossbody on Brody, which was really cool. Then Cope speared King, who was no longer legal. Willow cannonballed him to take him out of the match. Julia then knocked her out cold with a chain behind everyone's back, and she won with Heartless. Mercedes then entered with a chair. Julia ran away, even though Monet told us she wasn't cleared. She's there trying to get physical. Mercedes continued holding the chair, looking at Willow until Cope entered the ring, and then they shook hands for some reason. This was booked extremely well, other than the last part. I wanted to see Willow against the guys, and she got off a couple really cool moves on King, but the champion won the match, which she should have. This was one of the best parts of Dynamite on Wednesday, a really entertaining start to the show. It was actually one of the best parts on AEW TV this entire week. On Collision, Daniel Garcia beat Angelico after humping his face and locking in a grapevine submission. On Dynamite, the Elite fought Garcia, Pac, and Penta El Zero Miedo. There was no real booking reason for this match, though Kazuchika Okada and Pac both being in it made sense, and certainly the fact that Pac and Penta were previously teammates makes sense. Garcia is working with FTR, but FTR weren't involved directly in the match. So the team was fine, but the booking of the match just randomly happening came out of nowhere. Matt Jackson talked shit to Garcia live on a mic during the match. Garcia ate a Tombstone Piledriver, Super Kick Party, and a Rainmaker for the heel victory. The Bucks added an EVP trigger after the bell, brought out a ladder, and they continued attacking. Pac finally ran in with a bell hammer, just as Garcia was about to be crushed in the ladder. And I guess FTR didn't feel like saving their friend or getting involved on the go-home with their rivals who they're having this title match against. So, I can't explain that. On Rampage, Orange Cassidy beat Alex Reynolds, and he showed aggression hitting an orange punch on John Silver, who was ringside. The idea here is that he's enraged from the Trent Beretta attack last week. Orange was interviewed when Trent walked out, and then Chuck Taylor came in from behind Cassidy to kind of prevent him from attacking or something. Trent said he thought Chuck was his best friend, and then they both just walked away. It was pretty odd. On Collisions, Katsuyori Shibata beat Lee Moriarty with a PK, coming out of that random trios match from last week. He is now being referred to as the wrestler for a nickname. I think it's been a couple weeks. That's not bad. Anthony Ogogo was on commentary saying nothing the entire time. Shane Taylor attacked and Hook saved. Tony Schiavone is now doing the Hook announce like he's Sting. I thought that shit was over, but I guess not. I cannot get away from it. On Battle of the Belts, the FTW title was on the line. Hook beat Shane Taylor via referee stoppage with Red Rum in 10 minutes. And this was only booked because they had Battle of the Belts and they used the preceding segment with Shibata to have it make sense. On Dynamite, Orange Cassidy beat Taylor in singles competition with two orange punches after he was unable to hit Beach Break. STP attacked after the bell with a go-go hitting one body shot. Trent stopped Matt Sydal and Christopher Daniels from saving by taking them out with a chair. Taylor knocked Orange out with a punch, and Moriarty put him in a submission with the heels leaving on top. Such a weak group to take Orange out given all the adversity he's overcome, but it also kind of made sense in storyline and just the way it was booked. If STP actually becomes something, then this will ultimately be worth it at the end. On Rampage, Kyle O'Reilly backstage asked Rocky Romero for a match because they've had great ones before, and he believed that Rocky could help him get his groove back. Romero said he had at least one, if not two, matches scheduled against Roderick Strong. So O'Reilly suggested they fight later if he wins the title. Strong overheard this. He was bothered by the assertion that he might lose the title. And he said it sounded like O'Reilly was trying to go after him. Kyle said he would never ask for that, but since he mentioned it, sure, he would like one. Roddy said he wants him to be successful and win a title, just not his. The storyline aspect of this really worked for me. The idea that O'Reilly, who has been out of action for years, though, could just come in, beat Brian Keith and JD Drake, not wrestle in the month of April, and then be the number one contender for the international title, it's fucking ludicrous, friendship or not, especially when you consider the entirety of the AEW roster with people who have been working and winning and upping their profiles, whether in the rankings or not. On Battle of the Belts, Strong fought Romero in an eliminator match. Rocky, before the match, had no answer for what's going on with Best Friends. O'Reilly wished him good luck. Romero hit a nice avalanche sliced bread. Strong caught him flying with a pump knee for a knockout pinfall. Loved the finish. O'Reilly came out to check on Romero. He clapped for him. Undisputed Kingdom celebrated. Wardlow just destroyed Rocky with a clothesline. Then Roddy caught Kyle from behind with a pump knee, knocked him out cold, and said he told him he could do it on his own, and he made the wrong decision. So can he do it on his own, or did he make the wrong decision? I listened back to make sure I didn't hear it wrong. I didn't get it. Maybe it's just over my head and I'm missing something. It's very possible. This had no heat whatsoever. On Rampage, Anna Jay backstage was angry that women were kissing and not taking stuff seriously. She was confronted by one of the Joshi women, didn't recognize her, and I only point that out because Alex Marvez did quickly say her name. I didn't recognize it because she had only made that one really fast appearance last week. Also, I think he said her entire name when she really is known by three initials. So AEW never introduced her, couldn't even be bothered to put up a bottom third graphic on the screen when she walked into the camera shot so that we as viewers like, oh, that's who that is. Okay, I can connect those two things. It's so often like AEW just has no desire to educate its audience and just thinks we should know everything. Massively frustrating. And I could be wrong, but I believe it was AZM. So on Collision, we had Toni Storm fight AZM in an eliminator match. And you may wonder, why was she getting an eliminator match in her first ever match in AEW? That's a great question. Before this, Toni talked about kissing from last week, all the kissing, and she nearly pecked Mariah May on the cheek. She went with a hip attack in Storm Zero. This might have been Toni's best match as champion. Not kidding. Really fun stuff. Toni then licked Mariah's face a couple times after it was over for reasons. On Collision, Thunder Rosa reminded that she never lost the title, and she thanked the fans for supporting her comeback. She also said she doesn't want any of Deonna Purrazzo's help. Then she like paused mid-promo and gave a random stand-up for AEW speech before getting emotional about having an opportunity to reset her career, regain the title, and humble Toni while doing so. Outside of the weird part in the middle, it was a really quality promo from Rosa. She shows a lot of passion, and she can sell the hell out of a match when she's given the opportunity. On Collision, Purrazzo took a shot at Rosa in a backstage promo and said she had to refocus on winning the title, so she would start by taking out Mariah. This was a real solid match. May hit a hip attack and a tornado DDT like Storm does. She did it on Purrazzo. Deonna then countered a pinning sequence to get the win. The finish was clunky. The rest of the match was solid. Storm attacked immediately after the bell, so Rosa made the save and absolutely destroyed Luther while running to the ring. She just ran him over like a freight train. But Purrazzo took issue with this from the prior promo, so they pushed and shoved. May continued fighting Purrazzo. Rosa stopped a Storm attack and then drew on her face with lipstick. It was nice to see Toni get some comeuppance like ahead of a title match, especially because we all know she's going to win that match. But this has been booked pretty decently, I would say, all things considered, to get four different women involved in a storyline for a match that only actually involves two. I'm curious to see what the end result is going to be with Storm and May, because I can't imagine Mariah winning the women's title at the end of this, but maybe that's the plan because Mercedes is otherwise busy. But I am kind of curious to see how this entire deal plays out. On Collision, we saw Chris Jericho approach Taz backstage. That actually happened at Dynamite last week. He was wondering why Hook is ignoring him. Taz said he'd try to make a connection, but Jericho is probably pissing him off. And then it was announced that Taz brokered a meeting between them to be held on Dynamite this week. This was an in-ring segment. Jericho put himself over, saying everyone that works with him or goes into the Jericho vortex comes out on the other side as a better person and performer. He said he knows he can take Hook to the top if he sits under the branches of his learning tree. Hook ate chips in the corner and said no, he doesn't need the help. Taz tried to interject. Jericho cut him off twice, telling Hook he's not as good as he thinks he is. Taz tried a third time, so Jericho shoved him. Fans chanted, "You fucked up." Hook grabbed him by the jacket, said he likes him, but he crossed the line, and he'd take him out, so get out of his ring. Jericho, I actually thought was great here, outside of the forced Jericho Vortex reference, because he trademarked the term and he wants to turn it into something. Fans talk about the Jericho Vortex because that's really what has happened on AEW television. Someone will start feuding with Jericho. It'll go on for months and months on end. And then all of a sudden it'll be over and the person won't necessarily leave any better. Now, Hook, on the other hand, was awful. He's not believable whatsoever. The crowd saved this entire segment. I continue to like the story and dislike the execution. On Rampage, Jay White beat Matt Sydal in the main event with Blade Runner. On Collision, House of Black beat Sydal in Top Flight with a cannonball and double falling dropkick in the corner. Really fun show opener, despite it happening for no reason whatsoever. On Rampage, Zack Knight beat Angelo Parker, who bladed at some point. Zack screamed that he would take really good care of Ruby Soho, and then he hit a lariat for a false finish, plus a running elbow for the win. This was awful. What's not awful is something that happened Wednesday. Ruby revealed after Dynamite that she's pregnant, which is incredible news for her. And what totally floored me is the whole relationship with Cool Hand is a shoot, brother. So now, look, even if the storyline has been bad, it makes so much more sense why they did it in the first place. Good for them. Happy for them. I hope it's a healthy pregnancy. And I hope Ruby comes back when she's feeling up to it and gets to compete again. On Battle of the Belts, Serena Deeb said she was impressed with Yuka Sakazaki last week. She noted that she's undefeated since returning and is awaiting her title opportunity. The suggestion being they can fight and she can continue climbing her way up the rankings. And you know what? Simple storytelling works. She gave a reason for challenging a random person. It's to improve her profile so she can get a title match. And you know that simple storytelling works when even it's Serena Deeb cutting a promo. On Battle of the Belts, the ROH Women's Championship was on the line. Athena retained against Red Velvet. This was announced on Collision in a backstage segment as she and Billy Stark celebrated their recent success in Ring of Honor, which, of course, we did not see on AEW TV until this segment. Velvet also got a promo on the show. So AEW spent time on Collision promoting a Battle of the Belts match that came out of nowhere and was never built. This main event did. It actually got good time. Velvet hit a damn cool move off the ropes and a tornado DDT with a handstand sell. Athena flung her by the hair twice into the LED boards, punched her in the head, and then hit O-face for the win. Love that finisher. It's the best. Queen Aminata saved an attack after the belt, continuing an ROH storyline. Fun match overall. Better than most of what we get on AEW TV. In terms of Battle of the Belts in totality, I shit you not, it was a three-match show. One of them was an eliminator, and neither of the other two were for sanctioned AEW titles. It would be hysterical if it wasn't so sad. When they originally announced Battle of the Belts, I thought it was going to be like the Night of Champions network specials from back in the day where all the titles are on the line, or at least most of them, big time matches, and it is the most throwaway special show. I mean, you could argue it's more throwaway than Tribute for the Troops that WWE does. And they've even moved that into SmackDown. It was so throwaway. So, yeah. I mean, I have to do it, but that's 6 hours of AEW television this week. So with that said, folks, let's move to your AEW Dynasty Ultimate Preview. At the time we are taping this, there are 10 matches set for the card. We do have some extra content from all of AEW TV to discuss as we preview some of these individual matches, but we're going to break them down one by one. We're going to give you a prediction for them. And of course, we may talk, depending on the match itself, what it might mean in storytelling going forward. So we're going to start at the bottom of the card and work all our way up to the co-main event. FTW Championship will be on the line, Hook against Chris Jericho. It was not announced whether this is going to be under FTW rules, which it should automatically be, and yet sometimes it's not, so not 1,000% sure about that. And this is really interesting. It's actually tough to predict because Hook has already defeated Jericho. And I don't know that Hook beating Jericho a second time makes any sense unless this is really just supposed to be like a one-month story or a two-month story, however long it's been going on. At the same time, if Jericho is going to beat Hook, then all of a sudden he's FTW champion, which is actually kind of interesting. It would be fun to see that happen. But the question is, how does he do it without making Hook look bad? And the only thing I could think about would potentially be a return of Sammy Guevara to help him cheat. They win, and then Hook ends up teaming with somebody else, and they have a tag team feud going forward, and Hook eventually wins the title back off Jericho. But because I'm not going to go ahead and predict something that I just don't know is coming, then I'm going to have Hook retaining the title, Jericho attacking him after, and then that leading into something else. But could I see Jericho win the title? Yes. Do I think it would be more interesting if he did? Actually, yes, I do. I might be kind of sick of Jericho on TV, and I know a lot of people are, but Jericho beating him for the FTW title and doing this whole vortex storyline where all of a sudden someone goes into his orbit and is unable to leave, and he's doing this new character that he's doing, I actually think it's kind of interesting. But again, just for an official prediction, it is going to be Hook. The Trios titles are going to be on the line in a winner-take-all match. The Acclaimed and Billy Gunn, the AEW Trios champions, going up against the Bang Bang Gang, the ROH six-man champions. So Bang Bang Gang backstage on Dynamite had Jay White saying the Guns are better off with him than their father. White challenged to this winner-take-all match that we have known was coming for months, yet, of course, didn't get made until 4 days before the show. The faces later accepted. By the way, the Acclaimed and Billy Gunn, they have not defended these titles since January. The heels have defended them once in that same time, and that was on, I think, ROH Supercard of Honor. Now, at least we're going to get the end result here with the titles being merged, and that is really the best thing I can say about it. Now, in terms of who's going to win, it's super actually difficult to predict because I've always been of the belief that when you have a title versus title match, you want the person with the bigger title to beat the others. That way the smaller title gets merged into the bigger one and not the other way around. That might just be a technicality, but that's always the way I've thought about it. So therefore, my prediction would naturally be Acclaimed and Gunn winning the titles. But I do think that having White and the Guns, Bang Bang Gang, lose to Acclaimed, who are ice cold at this juncture, it only drags Jay White down even further. And I do remember a couple of weeks ago when they did that video package from someone's pool, that Juice Robinson was lurking in the background. Now, I don't know his health status, but I assume at worst he could walk to ringside and get involved in something. So I think we're going to get the return of Juice Robinson, the Bang Bang Gang winning and merging the titles, and Acclaimed and Billy going off and doing something else, hopefully something that is entertaining again, because they really haven't been in quite some time. Adam Copeland, Eddie Kingston, and Mark Briscoe are going to fight House of Black. Briscoe cut a promo on Collision saying he won't be intimidated by the House because his team is a trio of violent men. This is a situation similar to the one we just discussed earlier with NXT, where if this storyline is going to continue, then the only thing that really makes sense is for House of Black to win the match. You have Malakai Black wanting to challenge Adam Copeland. You could argue that someone else from them, Brody or Buddy Matthews, would make sense to challenge Mark Briscoe for the ROH title. But that said, if you look at people in this match who can and perhaps should lose, then really your only options are Eddie Kingston for the faces, and then both Buddy Matthews and Brody King for the heels. So it's more likely that you have a heel in this match that's able to lose. But just like I said with NXT, if you want the storyline to continue, the heels really need to get the win. So what I would do is have Brody King and Black combine to pin Kingston. He takes the fall. He's the only one that's not a champion. And then you set up two matches. You set up Malakai Black against Adam Copeland for the TNT title, whether they can wait until Double or Nothing to do it. I mean, that would be great because that'd be a huge match for that show. You could do that, or you can do it on TV, try to pop a rating. And then, hell, I would have Brody King go up against Mark Briscoe for the ROH title. I think that'd be a great match. We'll see if they do it. TBS Championship is going to be on the line. Julia Hart against Willow Nightingale in a House Rules match. Now, we don't know what the stipulation is going to be, and we probably won't know until the night of the show. What we do know is that Mercedes Moné is going to challenge the winner of this match at Double or Nothing. And generally, when something like that happens, you make the assumption, well, of course, the title is not going to change hands if we already know which challenger is coming up. I'm of the belief that I think that might end up being a triple threat at Double or Nothing. Otherwise, she's just going back to the Willow match, which was the match they had in New Japan, or she's fighting Julia Hart, and everything they're doing with Willow kind of gets thrown by the wayside. Given what we saw on the go home and the fact that Mercedes Willow just makes a lot more sense, I'm going to go ahead and pick Nightingale to win the TBS championship off Julia Hart. Next, the vacant tag team championships will be on the line. FTR against the Young Bucks in a ladder match. Now, you may say, Silver King, why is this a ladder match? Well, it was made into one for no reason whatsoever. It was just randomly announced on Collision, with Shivani making it sound like it was a massive deal. The Bucks on Dynamite cut off an FTR video package because the show was short on time, and they had Tony Khan sitting next to them in gorilla position, basically doing whatever they wanted. It doesn't help the idea that the Bucks are heels and AEW is a face if Tony just does what they say without being threatened or anything like that. But again, it also fits with him in reality, and I did think that it was a purposeful tongue-in-cheek moment that he sat there and kind of nodded along, kind of like he did next to CM Punk at the Brawl Out press conference, and didn't like step up or stop them or anything like that. I believe that was on purpose. And if so, that was actually pretty funny. I give them credit for that. Now, even though I'm criticizing this as a ladder match, let me be clear about two things. When you have vacant titles, putting them up for grabs in a ladder match, it is somewhat standard. I'm just saying nothing was done to build to it from like a violent standpoint or a challenge. Hey, we want these titles contested in a ladder match because it's where we thrive. If the Bucks had done that, it would have made all the sense in the world. They're giving themselves an advantage. They just announced it. So what I'm criticizing is the booking of bringing it to a ladder match, not so much the fact that it is a ladder match. I'm totally fine with that. Ladder matches are exciting. Now, this is a chance to steal the show because it is the Bucks and FTR. And you guys know I may not be the biggest fan of the Bucks, but I am a fan of FTR. And I certainly recognize the fact that all four of these guys, when they get in the ring together, they absolutely bang. In terms of who's going to win, I don't have much of a case for FTR. I mean, you could say it's elevating them and saying they're the first three-time champions and it's historic, and because the Bucks are EVPs, they shouldn't get it. But that's the gimmick they're doing right now. They are EVPs and they are trying to take advantage of every single opportunity. And who is the person that has been injected into this feud because of the all-in footage and because they wanted to inject this person into the feud? It seems to be Jack Perry. So it makes the most sense to me is for Perry to return to AEW, side with the Bucks, join the Elite, cost FTR the titles in this ladder match, and your new Elite is the Bucks, Perry, and Kazuchika Okada. Will that happen? Not completely sure, but if you're rolling with this new EVP gimmick for the Bucks, you cannot have them in a match for the titles where they pull all the strings and they control all these deals and then not have them set it up for them to win the titles. It just really wouldn't make that much sense to me. So I have the Bucks walking out as the tag team champions. International Championship, Roderick Strong defending against Kyle O'Reilly. Strong in a promo on Dynamite, promo package on Dynamite, said he would break O'Reilly and end him forever. I may be wrong, but outside of that quick backstage segment on Collision, where Kyle was like, yeah, sure, I would love to challenge for the title, I don't ever remember there being like a direct challenge or the match being made. It just got announced. Now, maybe I fast-forwarded through something and missed it. I totally accept that's a possibility. I just don't remember it happening. And it's great that O'Reilly's back, but they just put the title on Strong, ending a long reign for Orange Cassidy, really an extra long reign that was briefly interrupted in the middle. And if you put the championship on O'Reilly, what next? I don't really have the answer for that. So unless something happens like Wardlow turns on Strong, which they've given no indication for, given the fact that Wardlow took out his enemy on TV this past week, and I still don't know Wardlow is why he's associated with them. I thought he was going to go away from them after Adam Cole shit on him in that promo package. I don't know what's going on with Undisputed Kingdom, but they have the numbers advantage. O'Reilly does not. Strong just became champion. O'Reilly just came back. I have Roderick Strong retaining the International Championship. Continental Championship on the line. Kazuchika Okada defending against Pac. Pac on Collision cut a promo saying the attack after his challenge last week gave him a permanent headache and motivation to take down Okada. He said he's better than Okada, who is not God's gift to professional wrestling. It was actually a really good promo from Pac, as is usual with him when you give him time and opportunity. But kind of like the international title match, I don't necessarily see a reason to take the championship off Okada. And kind of like the tag team title match, if you're building up the Elite into this unstoppable group that has control over AEW, then taking the championship off a guy that you just signed and just strapped up doesn't really make much sense. I think this is going to be a brilliant match. It's going to be tough to be match of the night, obviously, with a couple that are still to come. But I have Okada, of course, retaining the Continental Championship. Moving to the Women's Championship. Toni Storm defending against Thunder Rosa. Nothing else extra to discuss here. Storm's title reign has been disappointing for me. Haven't found the matches to be very good outside of the AZM match on Collision recently. I'm really not into the character. I don't think it lends itself well to wrestling. Rosa just came back. Her case of the fact that she never got pinned for the title, it's a pretty damn strong one, and putting it back on her would make a semblance of sense to kind of put Storm in her place, get the title off of her, and allow her to just do her character away from the championship. But they have invested so much time and effort into Tony. They have the Mariah May aspect to the entire deal where she can interfere. They have Peraza, who certainly doesn't like Storm, but she also doesn't like Rosa. There are so many elements working against Thunder that really what makes sense the most in every single way is for Tony to retain the women's championship. Let's go to the co-main event. Now, we're going to talk about the match that is not supposed to main event the show, at least according to AEW, before the one that is supposed to main event the show. And that, of course, will be the non-main event. Will Ospreay against Bryan Danielson. And really, there's only so much analysis that can be done for this match because the storyline is as basic as can be. It is which between these two guys is a better wrestler. Now, there are two key aspects coming into this that are floating around in my mind. The first is that Bryan has been getting his ass kicked on television as of late. He's been fighting other members of the Callis family really for no reason whatsoever, getting beat down after the match. He has the one set for Saturday. So there's almost a built-in excuse where this guy is not 100% coming into the match and therefore loses to the younger, just as if not more talented, Ospreay. Then you have Ospreay, who's also been wrestling on TV, but of course he's been winning every match just like Bryan has. And unlike Danielson, He has not been attacked and is not experiencing any pain or lingering effects or anything like that going into the match. Now, this said, we don't know what's going to happen on Collision. It's quite possible they do the bunkhouse match, the BCC wins, Brian gets attacked after the bell, Ospreay comes out and actually saves him because he wants him to be at full strength or as close to it for their match the following night. And then Callis family attacks Ospreay, and all of a sudden, Brian and Ospreay are both injured going into their match. And therefore, whoever ends up winning, the loser has an excuse because of some body part that the other works on during the match that got injured because of the brawl. These are all possibilities, but we can't necessarily guarantee that any of them will factor into the match. So we just need to look at it as an apples to apples comparison between Ospreay and Danielson. And I did not mean for that to rhyme, I promise you. What makes the most sense to me, if I was booking this, would be for Brian to beat Ospreay and for them to do this rematch at All In. I know a lot of people are talking about, well, Ospreay should win the AEW title at All In. And I actually agree with that. In a perfect world, he should. But you're also strapping up, potentially, a new champion in April. And All In is only 4 months after that. Now, if there is a new champion and they have a four-month reign, is that the worst thing in the world? No. And I'd be totally fine with that. But the other consideration to make is if you don't want to go with a Danielson-Ospreay rematch at All In, then if Danielson does have a win over Ospreay and Ospreay does win the AEW title 4 months from now, you have a ready-made feud where Brian wants to fight this guy and try to win the AEW championship. And it could be a huge first defense for Will, where he's able to successfully defend over Brian, overcome the one person in AEW to this point that has defeated him. If Ospreay just beats Danielson straight up, then what onus is there to ever do a rematch between them? Think about it like what happened with Danielson and Okada. Brian beat him at Forbidden Door last June. They rematched in January at Wrestle Kingdom, and Okada got the win there. And I was coming into this pretty sure that I was going to pick Ospreay to win this match. But as I keep thinking about it more and more, I just think it makes so much more sense for Danielson to win. Because let's not forget, even though he has no problem putting anyone over, he's not retiring. In however many months when he said he's going to be hanging it up, he's just no longer going to be a full-time performer. You could possibly, if Ospreay does win the title between now and then, have Brian be that last match where it almost sends him into, let's call it, semi-retirement. But you can't get there. You can't have this match again if the younger guy wins right off the bat. So I think I'm going completely different and counter to what most people are predicting here. And it's very possible I'm wrong. And if Ospreay goes over Danielson, I'm not going to complain about it. I'm not going to say it was the wrong booking decision. None of that. It makes all the sense in the world. You're building Ospreay. Danielson's going out. You put over the young guy and you're building him, especially if he's on his way to becoming AEW champion in 4 months at All In. Very, very possible. There's just something sticking in the back of my mind that tells me they're going to go the other direction. And therefore, that's going to be my prediction. I have Danielson beating Ospreay. And if there's odds on that and my explanation there helped you agree with me in any way, maybe throw some beer money on that and maybe make a couple bucks coming out of AEW Dynasty. All right, the final match, what is expected to be the main event, the AEW Championship on the line, Samoa Joe against Swerve Strickland. Joe, in a sit-down interview on Dynamite, said he respects that Swerve doesn't give up, but he called him a punching bag because of it. Joe called Swerve a choke artist, given he loses every time he gets a chance at a title, and he promised to choke him out to end their match. Swerve later disagreed with Joe, and we got that weird, shifty camera work that we saw last week during an interview segment. He said he doesn't quit because of his military upbringing and a dynasty. He'll be called new champion. Then he took off his hat, and he seemed to have, like, fake black and blue makeup around his eyes. This was the first time Swerve did or said anything, as far as I was concerned, that was remotely babyface. So Swerve came out in the overrun for Dynamite, and yes, that was promoted before the show even began. He said Joe was scared of him last week. Joe stormed out with eight mostly out-of-shape security trying to stop him. So Swerve climbed to the top rope, jumped off the top, and Swerve stomped the security, like, vertically in their shoulders. It was awesome. He pointed out the title. He started brawling with Joe, and Joe easily took him out initially. Joe then distracted himself for no reason whatsoever by threatening Prince Nana. Swerve caught him with house call, but Joe took him off the ropes with a muscle buster to stand tall. Now, overall, this was a real solid go-home build to the match. Could have done this segment and neither of the interviews, and I would have been fine with it. But at the same time, I appreciated that AEW built it throughout the entire show and gave the title match a lot of time, especially considering how much concentration has been paid on Ospreay and Danielson for the last couple of months. I'll restate this. I said it last week. The only reason Swerve is a face is because fans decided they want to root for him. He never had a redemptive moment, and he remains the heel in this Hangman Page feud that, of course, is not happening on TV right now. Hangman only became heel because fans chose to cheer Swerve over him. And Swerve never did anything face against Joe. He's just been beaten down by him so frequently that there's sympathy for him. And it's why I'm not sure who to predict as the winner of this match. On one hand, every single sign points to Swerve. On the other, man, you know, Hangman running in during a referee bump and costing Swerve the title, that would create so much heat. And then you could have Swerve win the title at Double or Nothing, which is the bigger show. The problem with doing that, it's the repetitiveness of presumably doing another triple threat. Maybe the move is Swerve wins the title and Hangman either attacks or confronts after the bell. Maybe Hangman attacks when the referee gets knocked out, Swerve overcomes him and beats Joe anyway. I keep going back and forth on this one, but I don't think you book this match and not have Swerve walk out as the new AEW champion. So that is my prediction. And if you want to go further, I have Swerve walking out as the champion here and Ospreay beating him for the title at All In 4+ months from now. So that is the full breakdown for AEW Dynasty. As far as a pre-show expectation grade, and a reminder, we will allow you to vote and provide your own pre-show grades on Twitter at GettingOvercast about 1 to 2 hours before AEW Dynasty begins. As a pre-show grade, you know, this one's always tough because from a pure match quality standpoint, it is going to be tough as hell to beat this show. Swerve and Samoa Joe, Ospreay and Danielson, Storm and Rosa, Okada and Pac, Strong and O'Reilly. And sure, that may not be the most exciting match, but you're going to get some good wrestling there. FTR and the Young Bucks, exceptional. The rest of the card, whatever. But that's what is that? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's 6 matches that I just listed out there that all have match of the night potential, at least to some degree, maybe not Strong and O'Reilly. 5 of those 6 have match of the night potential. Now, we know it's going to be Ospreay and Danielson, but all the others are going to be awesome as well. So if it's just purely based on match quality, then I think my expectation grade needs to be an A-. But if I'm looking at it in totality and I'm recognizing that this is definitely what you would consider an AEW B show, at least in terms of prominence, they're sold about like 6,000, maybe 6,500 tickets for it. It's not a huge event like Double or Nothing. How much are they going to do on this show to just make it be epic? Do they feel that because WrestleMania 40 was so well received, they have to just go balls to the wall and go all out and put on what they would consider to be an A+ show? Maybe. But I'm going in with a pretty high expectation grade. I'm not going to go high on the A- scale, but just because of the match quality and the potential for there to be some really big moments on the show, I'm coming in with a pre-show expectation grade of an A-, a 90 out of 100. And I'll tell you, honestly, 2 weeks ago, I thought I was going to come in with a B. So they did some real nice go-home building over the last week. I'm still not really enjoying the AEW TV shows on a week-to-week basis. There's just so many plot holes. There's such a lack of storytelling. There's such a lack of reasons that matches happen on a week-to-week basis. But we know they always seem to deliver when pay-per-views come around. And I think they're going to do it again with AEW Dynasty. So folks, that wraps up this edition of the Getting Over Wrestling Podcast. Allow me to give you a bit of a reminder about a schedule to come next week. This has actually shifted a bit from when we spoke to you on Tuesday. So this may sound a bit different. Obviously, first on Sunday night, as soon as this show goes off the air, we will have your AEW Dynasty Instant Analysis Podcast. Do not miss that. We'll be back on Tuesday with your next WWE show. I spoke to Vintage Chris Vanini about this. We think it makes a lot more sense to do the WWE mock draft as a separate episode. So the plan as of right now is for us to do exactly that on Wednesday, a WWE mock draft. Perhaps I will also include an NXT breakdown on that show. Then Thursday, we would come back talking AEW. I'm not sure which show I'm going to put NXT on. There's also the possibility that we throw all 3 segments into one show. We do a WWE mock draft, NXT, and AEW all on the same show. I'm not going to be able to determine that until we get into the week and we see how much content we have on our rundown. Point being, we're going to have some real interesting editions of the Getting Over Wrestling podcast coming for you next week. On the way out, allow me to remind you as well that the Getting Over Wrestling podcast
is all about Defy.
So head on over to Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Leave a 5-star rating on Apple. Take a little extra time. Leave a 5-star written review. If you do, we will read it live right here on the show. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Getting Overcast for episode drops, news, analysis, highlights, all of that good stuff. It's also where you can send in questions and comments for the show. Again, on Twitter at Getting Overcast. And please also remember,
I happen to love the number 5.
And I hope you do as well. For $5 a month or $50 for the entire year, you can become an official Getting Overhead. Just visit buymeacoffee.com/gettingover. You will get bonus audio, instant reactions to Raw, NXT, Dynamite, and SmackDown every week, along with exclusive news posts on Friday. Again, buymeacoffee.com/gettingover. Thank you all so much for listening to this edition of the Getting Over Wrestling Podcast. We have plenty of performance-enhancing audio coming up for your ear holes. This is the Silver King signing off and leaving you with just 3 final words. Bye for now.